This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
A genocide under the watch of the international community cannot be tolerated. Another Holocaust in the history of humankind is not acceptable.
That was Kumbodzo Nsahansa, a minister in the South African presidency, on the cabinet's decision to withdraw its diplomatic staff from Israel, saying Pretoria sees attacks on Gaza as genocide. Details coming up. Also, flooding has killed over a dozen people in Kenya and displaced over 113,000 in Somalia. And officials are confident that the centerpiece of U.S. economic pact with sub-Saharan Africa will continue. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. In Israel today, Hamas and Israel have exchanged heavy fire, with Hamas saying it had launched rockets into Israel from Lebanon. The month-old conflict has claimed more than 10,000 lives in Gaza, the Hamas-run health ministry says. Israel says more than 1,400 people died in Israel communities when Hamas attacked them on October 7th. Hamas also took more than 240 people hostage that day and has them hidden in Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken today wrapped up his diplomatic mission in the region with a stop in Turkey. He said his discussion throughout the mission have focused on how to expand humanitarian aid into Gaza, how nations can make sure the conflict does not spread, and what can be done to create a lasting, just peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Israeli forces continue to press further into Gaza. The military says it has effectively cut off northern Gaza from the rest of the territory, and forces will soon move into Gaza City. We have journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem on the line now for an update on the latest. Welcome back to African News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you.
So we understand both sides have been exchanging fire. What have you learned today?
That there has been some of the heaviest fire since this conflict began in Gaza. Gaza City is surrounded, as you said. The Israeli army says that another top Hamas commander was killed, and Hamas claims that the death toll in Gaza has now passed 10,000. And there are still, despite Israel really pleading with citizens in Gaza to leave northern Gaza and move south, there are still an estimated 300,000 Palestinian civilians in northern Gaza.
So, Linda, essentially today there is a northern Gaza and a southern Gaza. Is there any word on what comes next for the Israeli military in northern Gaza?
Well, Israel is surrounding, Gaza City and says that it is making a lot of progress in trying to destroy the network of underground tunnels that Hamas has built under Gaza. And, Israel says that, those tunnels and Hamas bunkers include a large one underneath the Shifa hospital, where thousands of Palestinians are sheltering. And the general manager of the hospital, Mohammed Zakouk, says that the roof of a building at Shifa was damaged by an Israeli strike, resulting in deaths and injuries. The army has not yet commented on this, Israeli airstrike.
And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has just left the region. What has the Israeli response been to Blinken's visit and his message from the United States?
Well, Blinken, you know, talked about the need for more humanitarian aid to get into Gaza, and he also talked about a ceasefire or a humanitarian pause, as the president has called it. In terms of humanitarian aid, Israel says that it's willing to let humanitarian aid into Gaza, but it has to make sure that none of that aid is getting to Hamas. In fact, over the last week, Israel has allowed more humanitarian aid into southern Gaza, food, medicine, but not fuel. Israel says that fuel can be used to power the rockets that Hamas is still sending from Gaza towards Israel. In fact, there were some long-range rockets towards central Israel, and Hamas apparently even fired rockets from Lebanon at northern Israel. There were no Israeli injuries in those, but Israel has turned down Secretary Blinken's calls for a ceasefire or even a humanitarian pause, saying that Israel will not agree to a ceasefire unless all the hostages are freed.
Journalist Linda Grantstein updating us from Jerusalem. Thank you for your input.
Thank you, Yehias. Have a nice day.
The Southern African government has recalled all its diplomats in Israel. The cabinet also has directed the Department of International Relations and Cooperation to take action against the Israeli ambassador to South Africa because of Israel's continued bombardment of Gaza. The cabinet says it views Israel's attack on Gaza and West Bank as genocide and that South Africa needs to show its opposition to another Holocaust. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Khumbudzo Ntshavheni, minister in the South African presidency, said today the cabinet is disappointed by what it sees as the Israeli government's refusal to respect international law. As a result, she says the cabinet has decided to recall all South African diplomats from Tel Aviv for consultation.
A genocide under the watch of the international community cannot be tolerated. Another Holocaust in the history of humankind is not acceptable.
The cabinet also says the Israeli ambassador's position in South Africa has become untenable after he criticized Pretoria's position on the conflict.
Cabinet has decided to instruct DECO to take necessary measures within the diplomatic channels and protocols to deal with the conduct of the ambassador of Israel to South Africa.
However, Karen Milner, national chairperson of the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, SAJBD, says they are surprised by this statement and are seeking clarity.
While it is unclear what exactly that means, it does seem to go against the values of the ANC and our government, who have always espoused the need for negotiation, compromise, and engagement when it comes to all international conflicts. At this stage, the SAJBD have requested a meeting with President Cyril Ramaphosa in order to fully clarify the government's position in this regard.
The cabinet also took a swipe at the United States, saying its continued support of Israel undermines international law and the global system. Israeli officials say they are taking steps to reduce civilian casualties in Gaza and recently have allowed aid shipment into the enclave. However, it says it must eliminate Hamas as a threat after Hamas fighters killed about 1,400 people in Israel and kidnapped more than 240 on October 7. Israeli officials also say Hamas uses civilians and facilities such as schools, hospitals, and mosques as shields for its fighters. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Yesterday, my colleague Peter Clotie spoke with Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, a spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces, about the conflict. Here's a portion of their conversation.
The IDF is operating based on principles of distinction, military necessity, proportionality, and weighing up the three of those components together in order to achieve our military goal. In order to to conduct that, one of our main efforts in the last 3 weeks has been to evacuate people from harm's way. We've been encouraging people through text messages, through phone calls, through voice messages, through leaflets we've dropped from the sky, phoning people and encourage them to leave the combat zone. This is where Hamas is operating, in the north of the Gaza Strip, and you need to go south. It is safer in the south. There is no combat going on in the south. And that's what we've been doing. We've seen a huge shift of people. Around 1 million people or so have left the Gaza Strip, the north of the Gaza Strip, gone down south in order to get out of harm's way. And we did the same today, and they did the same today. So they're trying to keep people put, keep them in harm's way. Of course, that is a huge challenge for any military to operate in urban areas. And our goal is to try and limit the civilian casualties as the operation proceeds. It is an unfortunate reality of warfare but we need to remember, we did not ask for this war. We did not plan on going to war. So much so that the IDF actually failed the people of Israel, because we were working under the assumption that Hamas doesn't want to have a war with us. And they were able to conduct such a brutal massacre of over 1,400 people. They were able to rape, murder, butcher, dismember innocent Israelis. They were able to abduct over 240 Israelis and foreign nationals. And now we are responding to that to make sure that, not because of what happened on October 7th, 2023, but to make sure that October 7th will never, ever happen again.
Well, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner, before you go, talk to me about the latest development about Israel's border with Lebanon, especially following the recent clashes there.
So Hezbollah has been escalating the confrontation on the border with Israel. We believe it's under the instructions of Iran. We've had extensive rocket fire, mortar fire, attempts to infiltrate Israel. They've used drones, sniper fire, as well as machine gun fire. So there's lots of events that have happened. We have, I think, 5 or 6 soldiers on our side that have been killed in these exchanges.
That was Israeli Defense Forces spokesman, Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner. He spoke via Skype with my VOA colleague, Peter Clotie. Israel faces growing criticism from its bombardment of Gaza, with the United Nations, many governments and international aid agencies calling for an immediate ceasefire. Israel has said it would consider pauses in fighting to let aid into Gaza, but will not consider a ceasefire at this point, as it could allow Hamas to rearm and attack again. Israel also wants the more than 240 hostages Hamas holds freed. The French news agency AFP says at least 15 people have died in Kenya as floods swept away scores of houses and devastated farmland following torrential rains. The Kenya Red Cross says 1,000 livestock have died, while at least 97 hectares of agricultural farmland have been destroyed. In Somalia, at least 14 people have also been killed, the United Nations said on Saturday. The UN relief agency OCHA said at least 47,100 people have relocated to higher ground to avoid the risk of flooding, adding that the downpours have cut off access to markets and farmland in some areas. Reuters news reports that tropical rains have displaced more than 113,000 people and temporarily affected hundreds of thousands. Ethiopian-born scientist Gabisa Egeta, a Purdue University professor, is acclaimed as one of the world's leading plant geneticists. He recently received the National Medal of Science, the highest state honor attainable by scientists in the United States, from President Joe Biden. Jetta specializes in the study of sorghum, a popular source of food in Africa and the fifth most important cereal crop globally after maize, wheat, rice and barley. It is the second most important cereal in Africa and has been embraced as a staple by several countries on the continent, particularly those prone to drought. Growing up in Ethiopia, Gebisay Jetta's childhood was plagued by hunger and food scarcity, and he tells me the experience has heavily influenced his scientific research over the years, fueling him in his pursuit to improve food security.
I had a very simple life. I was born and raised in a small rural community in west central Ethiopia. My parents were poor, and as such, it's not a complicated life. I was raised by a single mother, and as such, the responsibility for my mother to raise me and provide me with all the provisions I need for proper nutrition and growth is compromised as a result of the poverty that was surrounding us. Hunger is a constant as a child, and just going to school in an empty stomach and, of course, rushing for lunch and so on. But as a result, I have seen hunger and challenges that poverty in our communities in Ethiopia usually surface. And so that's what I'm talking about. As such, I have become sensitive to the needs of the poor because of the surroundings that I grew up with.
So, Professor, you are acclaimed as one of the world's leading plant geneticists. You were given the award, Outstanding Contribution to the Science of Plant Genetics. What, in simple terms, is the science of plant genetics?
The plant genetics is a study of trait inheritance, you know, how human geneticists study about relationship between families and so on, and look into genes that express particular traits. And in plant genetics, we're studying crop plants, plants in general. And in my case, I was studying crop plant. And the crop I studied was sorghum. I've stayed with it from the beginning till the end, and therefore developed an understanding about the genetics or the traits of these crops and manipulating that for efficiency and productivity and disease control and tolerance to drought and parasitic weeds is the kind of research that I had done. So in simple terms, it's how to improve traits of crop plants to make them behave differently than they normally do. And that's what the science of genetics is all about in general.
So sorghum is the, as I understand it, it's the fifth most important cereal crop globally after maize, wheat, rice, and barley. Talk to us a little about the development of sorghum as an hybrid that is resistant to both drought and the parasitic weed striga, which commonly invades farms in Africa.
Sorghum is an important crop around the world because it's used for food, feed, and fuel. But it's particularly important in Africa where the crop evolved. Historically, the crop is evolved in the eastern part of Africa. Its homeland is said to be Ethiopia and Sudan. All the way it evolved between the Nuba Mountains of Sudan to the northern highlands of Ethiopia. And the crop evolved and started there and evolved and spread to different parts of the world, first initially to eastern and western Africa, and eventually from there over the Indian Ocean to the India and over the Himalayas, over later on to other places like China and so on. So it's an important crop for Africa, and Africans know the crop and raise it throughout the continent, and it's very important to them. But as climate change gets severe, even crop like sorghum and millet, which are very traditionally or inherently tolerant to drought, also succumb to that. And so the gist of my research has been trying to put in genes for drought tolerance, genes for parasitic weed resistance to develop this crop so that they can be utilized under severe stress conditions throughout the continent.
Just talk to us a little about your meeting with the president. Actually, he said that by developing sorghum strains that withstand droughts and parasites, you have improved food security for millions. Talk to us a little about your interaction with the president and the whole feeling, the experience you felt when you got the award.
You know, my interaction with the president is very brief, but even within that, it's an overwhelming and humbling feeling to be standing in front of the leader of the free world, to be acknowledged for contributions I made in the science that I practice.
That was Ethiopian-born scientist Gabisa Ejeta, a Purdue University professor, acclaimed as one of the world's leading plant geneticists. He spoke with me from the U.S. state of Indianapolis. Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, has underscored the need to add value to the country's rich mineral resources base, saying exporting raw minerals does not benefit the country much. Reporter Gudzanai Musengi brings us more.
Mining is one of Zimbabwe's top foreign currency earners. The government estimates it amounts to about 12% of the economy. President Mnangagwa recently expressed confidence that the country this year would achieve his government's target of boosting mining industry income to $12 billion. But he stressed the importance of adding value to minerals rather than exporting them raw, which he said does not benefit the country much.
Notwithstanding that mining is one of the major contributors to socio-economic growth, employment and wealth creation, over-reliance on the export of raw materials is unsustainable. Lessons from the present global socio-political and economic sphere demand that we de-risk our economies against global shocks, mineral price volatility, and other vulnerabilities.
The president made the comments as he opened the annual Mining, Engineering and Transport Expo a few days ago. Mnangagwa also urged mining companies to ensure that their environmental, social and governance initiatives benefit communities where they operate. He said they should invest in green technology to minimize the environmental damage mining can cause.
We only have one Zimbabwe, and our mineral resources are finite. Let us therefore always be good stewards and remain sensitive to the collective needs and the quest to improve the quality of life for the people of our great country.
Zimbabwe's mining industry has grown dramatically in recent years, spurred mainly by Chinese investments in lithium and ferrochrome, an alloy of iron and chromium, as well as the expansion of mining platinum, gold, and related minerals. Albert Makochekanwa is an economics professor and leader of a research team that recently produced a report on the state of mining in the country. Among the highlights of the report is that although production is set to increase by 12% in 2024, industry players are less confident about business prospects. That is because of lower global commodity prices, increased production costs, and shortages of electricity and foreign currency in Zimbabwe. Makochekanwa, however, says indications are that this year the country will hit the mining industry target in terms of cumulative value of mineral production and export receipts, including those from related businesses.
So 12 billion target, it's the total production of all the minerals, not only exports. There is that direct total production and also there are other indirect activities. So in summary, the statistics or figures are showing that, yes, as a country, we have achieved the 12 billion, which was a target, I think, 5 years ago.
Farai Magu is director of the Center for Natural Resource Governance, a local advocacy group. He dismisses the idea the industry will reach that target. Magu says there's nothing much on the ground to show for the purported growth of the mining sector because investors get rich, but most communities in mineral-rich areas remain impoverished.
Mining is a fraud in Zimbabwe. It's a sector where government is promising much, and delivering nothing to the people. Mining is actually contributing to a very big extent to the underperformance of government by way of promoting corruption, rent-seeking behavior, and organized crime. All the communities where mining is taking place in Zimbabwe are very angry, very frustrated.
Government is in the process of amending the Mines and Minerals Act, which is nearly 60 years old, and says that will help address many of the concerns of some rights activists and stakeholders. Reporting for VOA, I'm Kudzana Msengi in Bulawayo.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.